20. What is a revolution? Constitutional lawyers define it as a change of constitution by means not foreseen therein. By this definition, the Nazi Revolution of March 1933 was not a revolution. Everything went strictly by the book, using means that were permitted by the Constitution. At first, there were emergency decrees by the President of the Reich, and later a bill was passed by a two-thirds majority of the Reichstag, giving the government unlimited legislative powers, perfectly in accordance with the rules for changing the Constitution. Now, that is obviously shadow-boxing, but even if we look at things as they really were, there is still time for doubt whether what happened that March really deserves the name of a revolution. From a simple, common-sense point of view, one would say that the essential characteristic of a revolution is that people violently attack the established order and its representatives, police, army, etc., and overcome them. It need not always be thrilling and glorious. It can be accompanied by atrocities, brutality, plunder, murder, and arson. At all events, we expect revolutionaries to be on the attack, to show courage, risk their lives. Barricades may be out of date, but some form of spontaneity, uprising, commitment, and insurrection seem to be an essential part of a genuine revolution. None of that was to be found in March 1933. The events were a combination of the most disparate ingredients. What was completely absent was any act of courage or spirit by any of the participants. The month of March demonstrated that the Nazis had achieved an unassailable position of power. Through terror, celebration and rhetoric, treachery, and finally a collective breakdown, 1 million individuals simultaneously suffered a nervous collapse. More bloodshed has accompanied the birth of many European states, but none came into being in a more loathsome way. European history knows two forms of terror. The first is the uncontrollable explosion of bloodlust in a victorious mass uprising. The other is cold, calculated cruelty committed by a victorious state as a demonstration of power and intimidation. The two forms of terror normally correspond to revolution and repression. The first is revolutionary. It justifies itself by the rage and fever of the moment, a temporary madness. The second is repressive. It justifies itself by the preceding revolutionary atrocities. It was left to the Nazis to combine both forms of terror in a manner that invalidates both justifications. In 1933, the terror was practiced by a real bloodthirsty mass, namely the SA. The SS did not play a part until later. But this mass acted as auxiliary police, without any emotion or spontaneity, and without any risk to themselves. Rather, they acted from a position of complete security, under orders and with strict discipline. The external picture was one of revolutionary terror, a wild, unkempt mob breaking into homes at night and dragging defenseless victims to the torture chambers. The internal process was repressive terror, cold, calculated, official orders directed by the state and carried out under the full protection of the police and the armed forces. It did not take place in the excitement following a victorious battle, or danger successfully overcome. Nothing of the kind had happened. Nor was it an act of revenge for atrocities committed by the other side. There had been none. What happened was a nightmarish reversal of normal circumstances. Robbers and murderers, acting as the police force, enjoying the full panoply of state power, their victims treated as criminals, proscribed and condemned to death in advance. An example that became public knowledge because of its scale occurred some months later in the Köpenick area of Berlin, where a social democratic trade unionist defended himself, with the help of his sons, against an SA patrol that broke into his home at night to arrest him. In obvious self-defense, he shot 2 SA men. As a result, he and his sons were overcome by a larger troop of SA men and hanged in a shed in the yard that same night. The next day, the SA patrols appeared in Köpenick in disciplined order, entered the homes of every known social democrat, and killed them on the spot. The exact number of deaths was never made public. This form of terror had the advantage that, According to the circumstances, one could either shrug one's shoulders and speak of the unavoidable if regrettable side effects of any revolution, using the justification for revolutionary terror, or point to the strict discipline and explain that public law and order were being maintained, and that these actions were required to prevent revolutionary disorder overwhelming Germany, the justification for repressive terror. Both excuses were used in turn, depending on the audience being addressed. Certainly, this kind of publicity made and still makes the terror under the Nazis more repulsive than under any other regime in European history. Even cruelty can have a magnificent aspect if it is practiced with open commitment and idealism. When those who are cruel stand by their deeds with fervor, as happened in the French Revolution and the Russian and Spanish Civil Wars. In contrast, the Nazis never showed anything but the sly, pale, cowardly face of a murderer denying his crime. While they were systematically torturing and murdering their defenseless victims, they daily declared in fine, noble words that not a single hair of anyone's head would be harmed, and that never before had a revolution shed less blood or been conducted more humanely. Indeed, only a few weeks after the atrocities began, a law was passed that forbade anyone, under pain of severe penalties, to claim, even in the privacy of his own home, that atrocities were taking place. Of course, it was not the intention to keep the atrocities secret. In that case, they would not have served their purpose, which was to induce general fear, alarm, and submission. On the contrary, the purpose was to intensify the terror by cloaking it in secrecy and making even talking about it dangerous. An open declaration of what was happening in S.A. cellars and concentration camps, in a public speech or in the press, might still have led to desperate resistance, even in Germany. The secret whispered rumours, "Be careful, my friend, do you know what happened to X?" were much more effective in breaking people's backbones. The effect was intensified by the way one was permanently occupied and distracted by an unending sequence of celebrations, ceremonies, and national festivities. It started with a huge victory celebration before the elections on March the 4th, Tag der Nationalen Erhebung, Day of National Rising. There were mass parades, fireworks, drums, bands, and flags all over Germany, Hitler's voice over thousands of loudspeakers, oaths and vows, and all before it was even certain that the elections might not be a setback for the Nazis, which indeed they were. These elections, the last that were ever held in pre-war Germany, brought the Nazis only 44% of the votes. In the previous elections, they had achieved 37%. The majority was still against the Nazis. If you consider that terror was in full swing, that the parties of the left had been prohibited from all public activity in the decisive final week before the elections, you have to admit that the German people as a whole had behaved quite decently. However, it made no difference at all. The defeat was celebrated like a victory. The terror intensified. The celebrations multiplied. Flags never left the windows for a whole fortnight.